This is In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Here's Marie Osborne.
Well, happy 2016, everyone, from In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. We take a look back at the year gone by and some of our favorite interviews. We hope you enjoy them.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne.
Detroit civil rights leader Ron Scott passed away unexpectedly late this year. This fall, he spoke with us here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle about one of his good friends, the legendary Grace Lee Boggs, who had passed away. We found him relaxed and gracious as he gave us insight into this life well lived. The city of Detroit, and frankly, activists around the world lost one of their true leaders. Grace Lee Boggs died here in Detroit at the age of 100. She left a legacy that was far and wide, not just here in the Detroit area, but worldwide. And you really couldn't pick up a newspaper this week or listen to any kind of radio broadcast or television broadcast without someone noting her passing. Joining us is Ron Scott, founder of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, good morning. I'm also a member of the Boggs Center Board.
Oh, the Boggs Center Board. Very good. Ron, you described her in one word, grace. So tell us why you described Grace Lee Boggs with that one word.
Well, in terms of my growing up as a young person, growing up in church, grace represents a metaphor and a reality in terms of all of the intrinsic spiritual focus of loving and focusing on humanity, and also the strident presence that gives one the strength to go ahead and do the work that needs to be done to transform humanity. And in our last statements, the whole question was in terms of respiriting the souls of people and changing the nature of a circumstance from just a hard material framework that a lot of activists have done to and changing it to a question of dialectical humanism. That is, looking at how humans have developed over the past 500-600 years to be where we are, and looking at a new paradigm for America, not an America that's based on confrontation all the time, but a revolution of values, just like Dr. King talked about. Mm-hmm. So in effect, grace challenged a lot of people who use the mad perspective or the anger perspective, not that that's not worthy sometimes, into a situation of building relationships across race, gender, and class.
And talk about an unlikely success story, but it's truly an American success story. Boggs was born in 1915 in Rhode Island, the child of Chinese immigrants, grew up in New York City. Her father owned a Chinese restaurant on Broadway. And what most impressed me was her deep intelligence. She really, bar none, she won a scholarship to Barnard College for undergrad students. And I understand she went to college at the age of 16. Is that true?
Yes, she did. And she graduated and got her PhD in 1938.
And this was when women had just barely received the right to vote. And here she
this
is getting...
This is when Chinese babies, the girls in China and other places, were having their heads bashed against the wall and killed because they didn't want girl children to be born.
Right, right. I mean, she just exemplifies how her deep intelligence and her, you know, her ability to just break barriers, even at the age of 16. When did you first meet her?
I met Grace in 1968. I was just a young activist myself. I met she and Jimmy. And you have to know about she and James Boggs, because here it is, a woman and got a scholarship at Barnard, graduated, and got a PhD in 1938. And then you have James Boggs, who came from rural Alabama and was a factory worker and became an intellectual par none. The two of them married, got together, one black, one Chinese, one rural, one urban. And I'm telling you, Marie, you would love to have heard some of the arguments, discussions, because it was fantastic just sitting there. It wasn't, you know, they argued politically. They didn't agree, but they had a wonderful relationship. And that's what produced some of the political developments we talked about, like looking at urban rebellion and following the 67 rebellion,
right,
coming up with the term. Nobody knows that they came up with the term underclass, other things like that.
Wow, I did not know that. So they came up with the term underclass, which is now, of course, so accepted in public discourse when we talk about activism and civil rights. Tell me about her life here in Detroit. I know she came here in the 1950s. Is that correct? She came with her husband?
Yeah, early 1950s. Met James Boggs about the same time. And the two worked in a couple of political organizations, which they left. And then they formed and worked with organizations like Group on Advanced Leadership, worked with people like that you might know, like Milton Henry and others, in terms of dealing with the segregated facilities in the city of Detroit, getting African-Americans jobs and banks and so forth. And those are the kinds of things that she did through the 1950s. In the 1960s, they obviously were at the forefront of the burgeoning 60s revolution, the urban revolution, I might mention, and that Grace was one of the last members of the group that formed the Message to the Grassroots Conference where Malcolm X spoke. She and Malcolm X were good friends. She's one of the last ones that was living to be involved in that.
And she also tried to get him to run for Senate, right, Malcolm X?
Yes, she did.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that room.
Oh, well, Marie, if I could do my best Grace impression, she would say, "Now, Malcolm, you have to do something to challenge the people to move ahead. You have a great persona. You should do that."
And the Academy Award goes to Ron Scott. Oh, that's excellent. And also, all this activity with her and her husband gained her a substantial FBI file during the McCarthy era, of course, along with many others, we should say. But that didn't deter her. She pursued and she persevered.
Grace believes, and Jimmy and Grace Boggs were two of the first people who actually challenged young radicals not to dismiss America, but to embrace America. Is that America still is one of the best hopes for a revolutionary change, and that we should do that. We should love the country for its possibilities, not for its errant behavior. And so as a result of that, she welcomed that. She wasn't concerned about that. Those people were the people who were trying to move backwards. She was moving forward. And I should ask the answer that Grace and James Boggs created the whole focus in terms of development of agriculture, urban agriculture, and urban farming. That was one of their first things. They also are responsible for small bakeries like Avalon International Breads. That was their suggestion for creating a small business in Detroit. So every time you eat a roll at Avalon International Breads, think about Grace and James Bond.
I will. That's one of my favorite places on the planet.
Right.
Well, Ron
right.
Scott, just once again to review something you said. I'd read about it, but you said it so well, that Grace Lee Boggs took these young radicals and told them not to dismiss America, but to embrace America. And boy, could we use her now, the way we see public, political discourse going in this country. That's just a wonderful, wonderful way to say it. Not to dismiss America, but to embrace it and see change from within. Thank you so much for offering us this wonderful picture of Grace Lee Boggs, this person that we read about and hear about, but you brought her really to life for us today, Ron. We really want to thank you for your time.
I loved her, and I loved every argument we ever had.
I want to ride my bicycle.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne and Rochelle Riley.
They are everywhere. People on bikes. Rochelle, you work downtown. I work downtown. We see it all over. In my suburb, I see people riding to Detroit, back, everywhere.
I'm loving it. I love the new shops. I love what's happening. It almost makes me want to do it.
Yeah.
Just almost.
Almost. You don't have a bike?
I haven't had a bicycle in 20 years.
All right. We're going to fix that right now. Zach Pishak is joining us. He's the president of Detroit Bikes. Hi, Zach. We need to get Rochelle on a bike.
Well, I think you're talking to the right guy.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh my God, how exciting this is. And I looked at your website, and let me just tell you, I'm going to pretend I'm that model and I want that bike.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic.
You have beautiful bikes, Zach, that's for sure. Why don't you tell us about how you got started?
Sure. So the company got started in 2011. We started, well, first, we're kind of different from other companies because we're actually manufacturing the bikes here in the United States and actually here in the city of Detroit.
Yay.
So it started by finding a factory, and that was the big process, finding a factory and then building it out, and we just started selling bikes a couple years ago.
Now, talk a little bit about your background and what got you into bicycles. I don't know if you're a cyclist or you're a manufacturer or you're an entrepreneur who said, hey, this is what's happening. Tell us about that.
So my background was actually more to do with urban policy, so transportation policy and urban planning. I was a local business owner in Canada and got really interested in municipal issues and ran for city council. So I didn't get into the bike business because I'm an extreme cyclist. I got in because I thought there were a lot of people, well, like you, Rochelle, who are kind of on the fence about maybe, you know, hopping on a bike. So I wanted to start a company for people like you, just that kind of took away some of the complications that can sometimes come along with buying a bike. Sometimes they're pretty technical and, it almost feels exclusive sometimes. So I thought it would be nice to make a bike that was just, you know, a bike for people like me and for people like you, just basic, you know, a bike that is for riding. And that's kind of about it, you know, riding around the city.
First, let me say thank you so much because I'm so sick of the racing bikes and
yes.
all the gears and not knowing
it's
what to do.
It's not Tour de France.
I love your bike. There's a boys and there's a girls. That's what I want. How's it been? You know, you've got this 50,000 square foot factory and you're making bikes right there, you know, in the city. What's that been like?
Well, I've got to tell you, it's incredibly hard. It's really hard to rebuild an industry once it's left a country because you lose all that knowledge. So it's not like I can go down the street to the other bike factories and hire a bike production engineer, you know, with 10 years of experience. We just don't have that in this country anymore. So, you know, we've really had to rebuild things. There's 16 to 20 million bikes sold a year in the U.S. Only 50,000 of those are made here.
Wow.
And so they're made by individual builders around the country making very small amounts. But this facility we built can make an additional 50,000 a year. So we can double the country's output just from this one plant. But what goes along with that is a whole lot of learning, you know, for everybody involved. Luckily, there's some really talented people in Detroit, and there's a lot of people who have auto industry backgrounds. So they, you know, they know the mechanical side of it, and they can build this. But I would definitely not say it's been easy. It's been really hard to get to where we're at so far. And, you know, we're just kind of on that tipping point right now where now we just got to start selling these bikes. We know how to build them, and we know that we can do it for a good price. So now it's about getting the word out.
So is your next step then to train bike workers like the auto industry trained auto workers?
Well, that's not the next step. We've been through that step. The next step is really sales for us. So part of that is opening our new retail store in downtown Detroit at 1216 Griswold. But we're also in 110 different stores across the country. And we're going to work to expand that network. So really, for us, it's sales now. We've trained the people and built out the systems for production. It's just about, you know, getting people to try them out and see if they like them.
So it's not just buy American; it's buy Detroit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. I get it.
But well, the name Detroit now has such cachet around the country. I mean, listen, I saw a bike of one of your competitors at Neiman Marcus, for heaven's sake. So, you know, this would be the time to really get on that bandwagon to use that name to sell the bike.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what's nice for us is that we're telling a true story. You know, we're actually making the bikes. We're a company that actually has manufacturing equipment and makes stuff. So there are some other companies that, you know, will kind of write Detroit on a product and you know, charge twice as much for it, but maybe don't actually make things. And so not only do we have that nice name and that association with the city, but we're actually backing it up with really making stuff, which is
well, let me
exciting.
Ask this question, but first of all, let me just please tell our listeners, don't buy a bike at Neiman Marcus. That's number one. but can people go...
Rochelle, Neiman Marcus is calling. They want to talk with you.
Let me tell you, I've spent a lot of money at Neiman Marcus. I want the 90s back. I do want to ask about whether people can watch this process. You've got this huge thing in place. Do you have tours? Is it possible to see any of that?
Yeah, so we don't have tours open to the public yet. We're just working on getting that set up, but we will be offering tours. They're going to be starting on Fridays from our retail location on Griswold, and then we'll have a bus. You can sign up in advance for the tour, and we'll take people on a bus for a for a Friday afternoon factory tour. So we'll just do those once a week.
Yeah, and I've been to that factory. There's a lot to see there. I'm glad you're going to open the doors.
Yeah, you know, it's really our advantage. It's our competitive advantage that we have this facility and that we're producing. So we got to show that off.
How many bikes do you build a year?
Well, the first year we built 1,000. The second year we're going to be up around 5,000. And the capacity of this factory at full tilt would be about 50,000.
Well, 500% increase in just 3 years is pretty amazing, man. You also had some great news in April. You got the contract with Fat Tire.
Yeah, it's a huge deal for American bike production. There's never been a contract that's left Asia and moved to the U.S. Since Asian production started, every contract has left the U.S. and gone to an Asian producer. It's never gone the other way until now. So this is a big contract. It's over $1 million. It's for 2,415 bikes. And it's a contract that's been with Felt, which is producing over in China. It's been with them for 10 years. And so this is a big deal that an American company went out and won that contract. And it's pretty nice statement made by New Belgium Brewery that they believe in, you know, American production and that they kind of put their money where their mouth is stepped up and bought all those bikes from us.
Let me just give you an in the mix. Woohoo!
Yeah, for sure.
Fantastic.
Awesome. Very great. Zach, what's the next step for you here? I know you've talked about you want to increase your sales, obviously, and you're doing a lot of press. It seems like you're doing a lot of great stuff. You're opening the retail space. What's your next step, your next physical step?
Well, it's just funding us, getting from here to there. So we're probably about a year and a half away from profitability, so I need to go out and do a little bit of a fundraise and figure out how to cover off, you know, the time and, you know, paying everyone's salaries between now and then, and then, you know, continuing to ramp sales. So we just hired this guy Justin Manthi. He was with Electra for 13 years, which is another bike company. He started with them when they were selling 3,000 bikes, and when he stopped with them, they were selling 125,000 bikes a year. So he really knows the process and knows how to get a company accepted and in different stores and product moving. So we're pretty excited about him coming on board, and really just working with him is the key thing in front of us right now.
You've got to be thrilled, though, with people everywhere you turn. Like Rochelle and I said, there are people on bikes. I left the Fisher Building the other night, and there are people, a family, riding bike. I never saw that before, ever. You've got to be thrilled with that.
I'm thrilled, absolutely, and it was completely unexpected. I did not come to Detroit because I thought this was a great biking town and that there were a lot of customers here. I came here because I knew there were people here who knew how to make stuff, and I thought our market would be other cities. You know, I thought we'd be selling in Chicago and New York and, you know, San Francisco and Seattle, but it's been a huge surprise to see that the city's actually embraced cycling culture the way that it has, and that, you know, this is actually a legitimate market for us, too. A lot of our sales are coming from Detroit.
Well, Zach, I can tell you we love your philosophy. The words, "this is what we do," are echoing in my head. And I plan to help contribute to your bottom line because I'm coming over to get a bike. I'm going to get on a bicycle.
Awesome.
And
yeah.
I'm going to encourage my other friends who want a real bike to go buy a real bike that was made down the street. I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, and just think we could buy our car and a bike now.
There you go.
That
you
was made right here.
City that put the world on wheels.
It's putting them on wheels.
And now it's on two wheels. Zach Pashek, thank you so much for joining us, president of Detroit Bikes. We want to make sure that people will find you. 1216 Griswold is the location of the bicycle shop that's opening in Detroit. You're going to start with some tours. And when is, you said it's going to open in the next week, right, the shop?
The shop actually opened in May. So
I'm so sorry.
For business. Yep, no problem.
All right, so they are open for business. Excellent. And they can find you, of course, online.
Yeah, DetroitBikes.com.
DetroitBikes.com. And we'll put it on our Facebook page as well. And I'll be tweeting about it. I'll be tweeting pictures of me on my bike.
Yay. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you.
Thank you.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle is sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Once again, here's Marie and Rochelle.
Rochelle, you have any great trips planned this summer?
You know, I really do. My goal is to see Mount Rushmore for the first time.
Wow, excellent.
So I'm excited about that.
Excellent. The All-American Tour then, right?
Absolutely.
Joining us to talk about travel, I don't know of a better person to talk to about travel than Tom Parsons, CEO of BestFares.com. Hi, Tom.
Well, hello. It's one of those busy seasons right now.
Absolutely. Do you want to give us your, I know you're great at just giving us a quick taste. Well, where are the best deals to go this summer?
I think, okay, I used August 5th through the 12th, all right? And the reason I picked that gives you 30 days to pack your bags.
Okay.
And you don't have to rush. I will give you one insider secret, though. If you're trying to go to New York City, United every weekend has probably for the last 4 or 5 weekends has put on what we call last-minute getaways, where the cheapest airfare with advance purchase is about $249 mm-hmm. bucks round trip. But if you can leave on a Saturday morning, go to Newark, and then mm-hmm. come back Monday or Tuesday, we've been seeing those fares come in about $168.
Wow.
And you can buy them last minute. And from Newark, the best way to get down to Manhattan is just take the train right from the airport.
Right, right.
And you'll save a ton of money. But I think Manhattan in summer is a pretty good deal for the kids. And, it gives you – I can't handle New York more than 3 days anyway. So too many ambulances. But the other destination where you want some sun and fun – and also maybe a little South Beach, Miami, is Fort Lauderdale and Miami. We're seeing it come in about $149 in July and $149 in August. And you just have to – and Fort Lauderdale is coming in about $159.
What?
And that's probably one of the cheaper fares in the Florida. Excuse me?
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, so – but the rest of it goes – I mean, on the eastern part of the United States, I think you're going to find there's where you're going to get the better deals. If you're trying to go to Washington, D.C., now that they opened up the White House to take pictures, we can probably find – now, we can look at Washington, D.C., but it's running around $249. But you also want to look at nearby airports, and that's like Baltimore, where Southwest has it for $178. And now I realize that's about $70 difference, but if you got a family of four, it's $320, and that adds up pretty fast. So
that's
look at those
deal.
Nearby airports. Same thing with going to Europe. Our nearby airport actually has to be Windsor. And that's where we see the deal. Now, again, I used August 5th, peak summer, August 5th to the 12th. The good thing about Windsor, the airlines that go out of there, you get a couple things. You can get free stopovers in Europe, which we don't get here in the United States. We also get kids' fares, 2 through 11, up to 25% off. The adult fare, before fuel surcharges and international taxes, but we're looking at Paris out of Detroit August 5th, and it's $1,900.
Wow.
And yet we look at Windsor, it's $949.
Windsor, Ontario?
Yeah.
All right, Rochelle, we're off those.
Oh, my God.
What were those dates again? Because both of us are going. We're leaving.
No, you're talking $1,000 difference, a family of four, $4,000. You can now probably actually afford coffee over in Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Tom, how do people find these fares?
Well, you got to look around. I mean, we put stuff out. Detroit's actually a good hotbed for what we call snooze you lose.
Mm-hmm.
Delta has been hitting the United hubs and American Airlines hubs. And guess what American and United like to do back and to give them the thanks for hitting their hubs? They come in and raid Detroit and Atlanta and Minneapolis and Salt Lake City. And they cut the fares. I mean, like, we see airfares sometimes to Asia in the $700 range. We see even some Europe airfares will go on sale. And I think as closer we get to the fall, we'll see some big raids there, too. Delta's been very aggressive in fighting these other hubs. And I think you'll see more come out of Detroit. You just got to – if you got Twitter or Facebook, we put them out – every story we put out on bestfares.com, it goes right to you immediately. And then we put out an email twice a week. So you just have to look at them, see which ones. And you might not even want to go to Cancun. You know, we had Detroit to Cancun a week ago, okay? And I hate to talk about a week ago, but it was running $210 out of Detroit.
Wow.
And that was on United and American. And we were also getting 3 nights on the beaches at the Westin or the Intercontinental or the Fiesta Americana. 3 nights in August and September for $339. That's airfare and hotel.
That's unheard of.
So you might not be thinking Cancun at this moment, but for $339, guess what?
I'm thinking it now.
I can think about it, sure.
So keep an open mind this summer.
What about the fares what about these fees now that have gone up for carry-on luggage? That's just a pain in the neck.
Well, you got JetBlue. They were the last one that just got rid of them. You still have Southwest, and they are the largest airline within the 48 states. They carry more passengers than Delta, American, or United. And they still have 2 bags free. They still have what we call change fees, $200 on Delta and the other airlines. where Southwest will not charge you for a change fee or cancellation fee, which is good. But you have to watch out for airlines like Frontier and Spirit, which have come into Detroit pretty heavy. And when you have fees for carry-on bags up to starting as low as $30-some, but if you don't remember that, it can be $100 at the gate. And that's each way.
Wow.
And that's just for carry-on. So plus their seats are only 28 inches. I think when you're booking Spirit, you just have to be careful. Sometimes it may work for you, but in most cases, I'd say look at the other guys, add up all the fees, especially the carry-on bags, and see what comes out. And then you may find that the other guy's cheaper.
Now, Tom, I've always been told that it's cheaper to buy airline tickets on Tuesdays, and you know you need to buy them in advance. Are there any other tips for the best time to buy your to plan your trip and to buy your tickets?
Well, I mean, Tuesdays, the only reason, I mean, I'd suggest Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and probably maybe Wednesdays, too, because Tuesdays, that's when the airlines come out with the airfares. JetBlue will come out with theirs, Southwest will come out with theirs, and the other guys, but sometimes you got to wait 24 hours and let the dust clear, and they usually run for 3 days. Usually it's JetBlue usually does 2 days, so you got maybe Wednesday's a better day to look, but I think Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, but because of the snooze you loses, it can happen on a weekend. It can go anytime. And I still think you just have to keep watching. I think you've got to book at least 21 days out, probably more. If you know you're going somewhere or want to go somewhere 60, 90 days from now, I'd start looking now. And as we go into September, October, I expect big, big price drops out of Detroit and other cities around the country. And Europe will come down $500 to $700 out of Detroit.
Wow.
And we'll probably see a lot of deals into Mexico and the Caribbean because it's a slow season for them.
I'm going to grab my calendar.
Yeah. You know what, Tom? We're going to have you back on the show in the fall. We'll talk about some of the late fall travel bargains out there. As always, just a fascinating guest. Thanks for joining us here on In the Mix.
Well, thank you very much.
And Rochelle, coming up next, we're going to be talking to a local meteorologist who really had quite a trip of the lifetime with his son. If you like mountain climbing, you're going to hang around for this one.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle, sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
How you feeling?
Can I just scream? All right, we're a little...
I don't get a lot of that, you know.
Peter Frampton, thank you for joining us here on In the Mix at WJR. You are one of the world's greatest guitar players, period, and we're just thrilled that you could join us here today. And we're listening to one of your biggest hits, your biggest successes. You're going to be playing at the DTE Theater a little bit later on this afternoon. We're, again, thrilled that you could join us. You know, we all remember you on that famous shirtless photo by mm-hmm. Scavullo, but you said one time that you were sort of regretting that you ever took that picture. Rochelle still has it hanging in her office, but maybe I do too, but do you want the regret?
In the scheme of things, it was just part of what was done at that point, but I think it was just that. It was just overkill, I think, with the amount of times you saw me with my shirt off.
well,
you know, people back then and this one and that. So, you know, I was young and a little sort of, you know, stupid. And no, it's just, I think the image of the musician left. If you have, before you have some sort of hit when you're in your 20s or whatever, and people are listening to your music and they don't really know what you look like, it's on the basis of what they hear rather than, you know, what they, it's not blatantly put in their face. I think once the teen image was plastered everywhere, I think that's when the girls come to the front of the concert and the guys go to the back, you know, and then you've lost 50% of your audience because the guys are jealous.
That's a good point. Well, I just want to say that you will always be 26 years old to me, yeah. And Frampton Comes Alive is just, you know, like timeless and classic. And I want to take you back and talk a little bit about the success of that album and what that felt like, you know, leaving Humble Pie and going out on your own and then having something that huge in 76. Can you just think back to that and talk a little bit about that?
So We had, before I went away on vacation, we had one concert sold out at Cobo Hall. Well, when I came back 10 days later, there was four shows sold out. So it was like so evident, there it was, a slap in the face in a good way. Wow, there's a huge demand. And of course, the album had just literally come out at that point. So, and Detroit was always a very, one of the biggest markets for me before any sort of chart success. So it was a really good telltale sign that things were just about to go berserk, which they did. And then 76 and 77 and 78 were kind of a whirl, you know. So it was it just went into hyperspeed and became very things became very surreal. I think is the way to, because you go from not being known and being able to walk around, and then all of a sudden one day, wherever you go, you know, there's people running after you.
And you're on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it seems to happen overnight. But of course, we all know that it took many years before I had that album that came out. But it definitely, it changes everything in your life, basically. I mean, your privacy is the first thing that goes. It's just like anybody, any notoriety, a politician, an artist, a guitar player that has a huge, or an author who has a huge book, or whatever. You become this known entity, and then you are theirs. You're no longer yours.
You've had success, though, after that. Now, granted, you haven't had the cover of Rolling Stone open shirt success that you first had, but you've continued to produce albums, and they've reached a lot of critical acclaim, again, because of your true guitar talent, your abilities on the guitar. In these later years that you've been still producing albums, what do you think still drives you to want to put them out there?
Well, it's, I'm going to make music whether people buy music or they rent it or stream it,
yeah.
Flag it down, run out in the street and stop a car and say, do you have a CD? I don't care how people get to hear me. I'm still going to make music because I make it for myself first. And that's, I think, the most important thing is that whether there was demand for me to go out and play a show or not, I'd still be making music for myself, you know. So it goes back to that one's passion, I think, can be recreated. I mean, you can lose a passion for something, and I feel sometimes that, you know, it just after touring all year or whatever, and I get off the road and I think, oh God, and I take a couple of days off and I don't look at a guitar or listen to music, and then by the third day I'm like, where's that guitar? Wow. You know, it's just inherent in me that I have to pick up a guitar and play it. It's part of my life.
Now, are you looking out in the audience and seeing those teenage girls who are now not teenagers anymore? Or are you getting a sense that the audience is very diverse and people who just love good music?
It's very diverse now. It's all ages. We've got, you know, three generations, post the teenage ladies that were there when I was a teenager, basically.
Wow.
So now you've got, 12-year-olds at state fairs that sing along with the music because they've listened to it at home because of their parents. So, yes, it seems to regenerate itself and throughout the generations. So I'm very... I guess I'm very, very lucky to have had a record that reached so many people that it's something that just does get handed down, you know?
Tell us a little bit about your musical influences. Who were your guitar heroes growing up, maybe?
Elvis's guitar player, Scotty Moore, was a big influence.
Mm.
There were other... Aha! Hold on one second. I have to change areas. No? Okay. Okay, I'm just... Sorry, we are taping. I got to close the door. I'm doing an interview, Eric. Sorry. No. How do I turn the lights on in here now? There we go. Okay, sorry.
You're talking about Elvis's musical influences.
Elvis's guitar player, Scotty Moore, was a big influence. But also Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, and... then those were the Americans. And then the English people were Hank Marvin, who was very big influence on me, the lead guitarist of Cliff Richard's band, The Shadows. And so, and then my parents were listening to Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, the Hot Club de France. And so I got this rock side, rockabilly, as well as, you know, with Scotty Moore, and then the jazz side from my parents. So between the two, you know, I got educated into what is possible and what is out right now, you know, because Django Reinhardt is arguably the best guitar player that ever lived.
You know? Wow. Now, you know, I love that you played in bands when you were very young, you know, the Little Ravens when you were 12. And I read about how you and David Bowie played on the same bill. He had George and the Dragons and you had that. Are any of your children musicians?
Yes, my son Julian and my daughter Mia, both of them are musical. Julian is actually playing out around town in Los Angeles now with a duo, and he's looking to form a band. I did some recording for him, you know, and he's working on a musical career. That's what he would like. It's not the best time in the history of music to have start a music career. It's very difficult.
Well, I can tell you right now that you have made a huge impact on the lives of so many people, including me, and we are so glad that you joined us on In the Mix. And my last question is, are you still living in Nashville, and can I get that address?
Did you notice that laugh?
I am still living in Nashville, and I'm in the Gulch.
Oh, wow.
All right.
Thank you,
Peter,
so much.
Have a great show later today at the DTE Theater. We're so thrilled that you joined us here on In the Mix.
It's our favorite venue of all time.
Woo! Yes. All right, so this was a thrill having Peter Frampton on the show. And I have to confess to one story. I was going to tell him, but we ran out of time. The one Peter Frampton memory that I have is, it must have been 77, 78. I know I'm really dating myself. My brand new VW Bug with the sunroof open and my Farrah Fawcett hair pulling up in the driveway at my parents' house. And that Peter Frampton, you know, album in the 8-track, blaring out of the car, and my dad saying, "Marie, you can't do that in the neighborhood. They'll call the police. The neighbors will call the police."
You were way before your time.
Yeah,
the loud music
for sure.
From the car. What's an 8-track?
No, yeah, right, Rochelle.
This was a great, great show. We want to thank everybody for joining us on In the Mix. Have another great Sunday, and we'll see you next time.
And keep in touch on Facebook.com, In the Mix, WJR.